Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 385, being recorded on the 14th of July, 2021, with special guest Rob Vetter. I'm Sujit, and on Teams with me, we have Cynthia, Kale, Evan, and of course, our special Rob, who we're going to get to in just a minute. But before that, let's talk about some news. I believe we have, what do we have this week? We have some internal conferences going on, right? I think there's the Inspire conference.
Yeah.
And so normally around the time of these conferences, there's a lot of new updates that are released. And so there's quite a few things that we have on the in the show notes today. So Cynthia, why don't we start with you?
Sure. I actually just have one. It is the public preview of API management and event grid integration. And for people, for our listeners, event grid is a way to send event notification and as kind of a accumulation method of what type of events you want to pull in and then how you want those notifications to go to different services. And now there's also just native support for Azure Functions and Logic Apps. So what you can think about is if you have something from your API M and then certain events can trigger additional actions once that happens.
Yeah, it's really nice. This is just Rob. I love the fact that you can say, hey, I'm in Azure and I want to have, like you said, maybe an event, I want to have maybe a Logic App or say maybe a storage account trigger a Logic App. And that's all built into Azure. So I'm not having to code the, you know, my publish and subscribe methods. I don't even need Dapper. It's just built into the platform, right? I just go in and configure it. That's really nice.
Yeah, I think it's one of the hidden gems of Azure for sure.
Yeah.
Kale, I believe you have a couple of items in there, and then I'll go out to you.
Yeah, sure. I got two here about Inspire. This conference is going on, so people should check that out. Or maybe by the time the podcast is up there, you could go and look at some of the videos. But it's a partner conference heavily centered around our partner ecosystem. And so there's a nice blog post here from one of our the COO about, you know, the partner ecosystem, some changes that are happening there, all, you know, for the good, on the Microsoft 365, this ISV Connect program, some things around transaction fee reductions, like the cost to put things in the Azure Marketplace is dropping substantially. I don't know what all the fine lines are there, so we'll have to cover that in another podcast, but there's definitely some good things happening there in the ecosystem for our partners. The second one was around, you know, this isn't a conference where we talk a ton about product, and that's usually things like on our developer conference or others, but there was, you know, there's always new things coming in Azure, so this was a time where they announced some new things. This Windows 365 sounds cool. I don't know as much about that yet, but it's a VDI type thing with Windows 11. Sounds really neat. There's also like some features for Windows Server and SQL Server that they've extended some of the security updates and things like that that are in there. A bunch of things around our database platforms like CosmoDB. There's a bunch of new features there that they talked about. And obviously the hybrid cloud with Azure Arc and otherwise. So lots of good links there. I won't belabor our discussion here today with those, but there's quite a bit of cool stuff there that we'll have to dig into. The technical one I did want to talk about real quick was Bastion. For those who haven't been using this,
Bastion,
it's super cool. I've used it for a while, and those who have used things like what we call jump boxes, when you have a production workload, you typically don't jump directly onto the, you know, compute nodes or otherwise up there. Bastion is essentially jump box as a service, for those who don't know. So instead of you know, if you take a simple case like a VM, instead of exposing that to the internet and then, you know, putting NSGs and things around it, this would allow it to stay private. And then this service sits in front of it that allows you to control access, monitor it, all the kind of things that you want to do to get in to manage it when you need to. So super cool. I don't think it gets enough press. I think it's super awesome. And there was a nice blog post written up about it.
Kale, with Bastion, do you still have your Jumpbox and then Bastion kind of shielded it, from the public?
It,
or do you
it
just
is your Jumpbox, basically, at the end of the day.
Yeah. What Evan said.
Sorry.
So that would mean you could close your, you can probably close your RDP port then too. Is it 40, 439 or whatever it is? Yeah. I mean, you don't need that. So that's one less thing to, you know.
It's kind of interesting too with like the PaaS or the managed app stuff, like for instance, AKS. When you do that, you have to set up a specific subnet. It has to be named a certain way and all that kind of thing, and then it will communicate with a Bastion host, and then you could jump onto there. So there's like other layers that are in there that are pretty nice to protect your workloads, you know?
That's nice. Well, I have a couple of a few updates, actually. Two in the Spring Cloud area and two in the AKS area. I'm sure Rob will have something to say about that. But let's start the ones in Spring Cloud. So Spring Cloud is our service for running Spring Boot applications. And it makes it really easy. You can drop jar files into the Spring Cloud and everything else is taken care for you. It used to be the cost of entry was pretty high. I think the minimum was $1,200 a month, I think, was the minimum for the standard edition of Spring Cloud. And then you pay for all the overages. I think that for some people, that's a little, you know, high entry bar. So what they've done is for the standard SKU now, they've reduced the entry price by half, and they've reduced the what you get with it by half. So you get half the number of CPUs and memory by default, but it costs half as much. And then you just pay for the overages like you did before. It just makes it a little easy to get into Spring Cloud. You still get all the facility that Spring Cloud has to offer. You know, the DevOps integration, everything is there out of the box for you. You don't have to worry about containers, et cetera. It's gone built in the background for you. So that's one nice thing about Spring Cloud. What I didn't know was Spring Cloud also has now a basic SKU, which is if you just want to kick the tires, and that's even less price. I think like maybe a couple of hundred or so dollars for that. And that comes with just 5 CPUs and 10 GB of RAM. So that's some of the pricing changes for Spring Cloud. Also in the Spring Cloud area, it used to be we only had Azure Monitor integration in terms of monitoring, and now New Relic, who's one of our partners, and I'm sure this was probably announced today because of our partner conference, but New Relic now allows you to natively integrate with Spring Cloud. So right out of the box, you could say, you know, I want to connect this Spring Cloud instance to my New Relic, which I already have on-premise or elsewhere. The New Relic Cloud, for example, and it's everything else is automatic from there on. You know, you get all the insights that you expect from any monitoring solution there. Third up is have an AKS has, you know, when you set up an AKS cluster, I'm sure as Rob knows, there's like 1,000 things you can configure in there, right? And probably misconfigure as well. It's easy to shoot yourself in the foot with AKS. But now they've come up with this new feature called Smart Defaults, right? So if you have, they have come up with this, a few scenarios. Maybe, you know, you want to do like a DevOps scenario or a dev test scenario, or you need a hardened cluster, you know, batch processing, whatever. They've got a few scenarios and you can pick from that and it'll automatically give you like a bunch of defaults that make sense for those scenarios. So right off the bat, you're going to get a cluster that's, you know, pretty much there where you want it, and you can tweak just a few knobs to take it all the way to your needs. So that's in preview right now.
I love the smart cluster stuff as well as the New Relic stuff, because if you think about it, right, it sort of goes back to the premise of the cloud, right, which is that I can move faster. And, you know, things like, hey, connecting up to my New Relic, you know, destination, or, you know, configure my cluster for workload A versus workload B, like that used to be this run sheet, right, that we all did. And it really wasn't value added work. But now you click a button to do it. So sort of abstracting and sort of moving up the stack like that, that is the promise of what, you know, the cloud is supposed to deliver for all of us. And it's great to see this kind of stuff land.
Yeah, sort of bakes in like, almost like bakes in best practices out of the box.
Absolutely.
you're really saying, hey, you know what? You know, I'm new to AKS, typical scenario. I have no idea what happens. This stuff is doing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You start making decisions, but you're not really sure, right? But if I can start with a baseline that is proven for my particular mm-hmm. scenario, there's value there. I mean, I can go in and tweak stuff, right? But at least I can go to bed at night knowing that, you know, it's probably okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then related to AKS as well is when you create an AKS cluster, even if you do the Azure AD integration, it still creates the base admin user ID in AKS. So there's like, you know, you've done all this work to create the Azure AD integration, but somebody can still log in with the admin credentials, which, you know, unless you go in and disable it, it's there. It's like a right. backdoor. And so now there's a new feature, I think it's in preview, where you can disable the local accounts when you create an AKS cluster. Okay. So, but off the bat, you know, you'll get a cluster with no local accounts, only Azure AD integration. So this way, you know, you know that somebody has to be logged into Azure AD to get to your cluster. I think that's a really nice feature.
Not to poke a wound there, but if you shut it off and it's only Azure AD, and then Azure AD has an issue, is there a way to like enable that? It's just a question. I don't know if you know the answer, but like.
I would think that, you know, by setting this, they actually remove the accounts. Yeah. You know, they probably just take them out. But again, yeah, I mean, I think the whole of Azure runs on the premise that Azure AD is also up and running. I think if Azure AD goes down, we've seen in the past a lot more stuff won't work other than yep. getting to your AKS cluster.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
Thanks, Cam. Thanks, Cal. Thanks for bringing back that painful.
You gotta keep it real, man. I mean, stuff happens, right? Like,
it's an ugly day, isn't it? It's an ugly day. You look outside and the clouds are all dark and everything, and it's like, this is lightning coming down. This is not good.
And then one last one, and I promise we'll get to Rob in just a minute or two, is. You know, when you do an app service application, if you use .NET, you know, you get some really good integration with Azure Monitor, where it can provide a lot of insights into your .NET application. You know, I mean, I guess I said Azure Monitor, I meant application insights. So, you know, you just say tick the box for application insights, and it gives you very detailed integration into your .NET app. You don't have to do any tracing, any observability in your code. You get it for free, right? But it never used to work for Java and Node.js. It only worked for .NET. And now they're releasing a similar feature for Java and Node.js applications that run in App Service. And basically, they deploy a special agent, like in the case of Java, they deploy a special jar file that runs along with your application in the JVM, attaches to the JVM under the covers, you know, gets all the insights, and then sends it off to application insights, so you could see all of that, you know, JVM usage, threads, everything, you know, even doing like profiling, whatever you want to do. So I thought that, you know, that's a really nice feature. And I think we, you know, this is just a sampling of all the news that was released this week. As I said, there's a lot more. We just picked a few that we thought were noteworthy, at least for the audience over here. And Evan, I know you're talking about, you know, bringing back bad memories. I know in a couple of episodes ago, I made a comment about how, you know, I had a bad experience with with support. Like, you know, my MSDN subscription was suddenly disabled. Yeah. It was past its time, you know, age. I don't know if they have all these subscriptions have a specific age, but it was suddenly disabled and had a few kind of losing things there. You know, I wanted to just copy into another subscription. I couldn't do it. I opened a case and didn't hear back from them for many days. And literally, as I was on the show talking
the support team heard you and said, "Oh,
I get an email from them saying, oh, yeah, you know, we've re-enabled your subscription." I was like, wait a minute, this is not a live show. You know, how the hell did they know we were recording at this time?
We're always watching you.
I can see that. It makes me wonder. Anyway, so let's get to our special guest. Rob, thank you so much for joining us today. Please go ahead and introduce yourself to our listeners and let us know what your passion is in the Azure space, and we'll take it from there.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me, too. My name is Rob Vetter. I'm a cloud solution architect in the CSU Fed group, which is kind of interesting. So I've been there about 6 months, and you know, it's a whole new customer, it's a whole new environment. But my passion is really app app innovation, app dev. I think app innovation is our new term for it. You know, a lot with microservices, definitely a lot with cloud native, Azure PaaS for sure, serverless, really in that space pretty much. And I've been fairly deep into the design to dev side of it, working with customers. And then as I got into a CSA role, I've been getting, still doing some of that, but getting a lot deeper into the infrastructure and the DevOps side of things now too. So it's been a good experience, you know, but those kinds of things pretty much just love Azure. You know, it's like a big kids toy almost, you know, the way I look at it. You know, I can sit like on a Friday night and I can go, wouldn't it be cool? I'm looking at this, you know, particular article. I want to do this because I want to be able to connect this to that and that to this. And then, of course, you know, things don't work, right? But that's when you start learning. Why is it not working? You begin to dig into the internals. And next thing you know, it's midnight and you're going like, oh, man, I'm not young. Got to turn this off.
So, and just for our listeners, just so we can expand on some of the acronyms you just used earlier. So CSU is the Customer Success Unit, I believe, right?
Yes.
And what is that? Just like in a sentence, what does that team do?
It is basically a team that is customer facing. When you're dealing with your account executives, when you're dealing with a lot of Microsoft, you know, face to face, a lot of people. That particular side of the house. So we're sales oriented in the fact that, you know, we do work with the sales team, but I'm not a salesperson. I'm more a technical person than a sales team. Yeah, but the customer success unit is a fairly large group at Microsoft, and it spans all these different what we call OUs, you know, finance, government, medical, so on and so forth. And then the CSA, by the way, too, that's called a cloud solution architect role. So there you're pretty much a technical person, but you're also very much involved and you're very close to the customer. So it's fun.
You also mentioned Fed. You mean the federal, like you work with federal customers. Is that what you mentioned?
Fed would be, you know, all basically federal customers. So, and the federal team is interesting. They've just stood it up within the last year. It has become its own independent organization and it's growing like crazy. So we're really ramping up over there. I mean, like a lot of people, they hired too many people, but a lot of people. It's split down the middle. There's the defense side of the house and then there's the civilian side of the house. I'm on the civilian side right now, but the defense is doing really well as too. There's a lot going on over there. So it's but you know, when you get into, but the selling cycle is different. Certainly the needs and requirements are different, you know, just like a lot of things in regulated industries, just a lot on security and identity, as you can imagine. You know, everything is, that's always the first conversation, the second conversation, the third conversation. And then we start getting into other stuff pretty much. So everything is very locked down. Really, as it should be. They even have, it's interesting. Then they even have different clouds as well, too. So we have our commercial cloud. But when you get on the federal side, there are other clouds that you typically never see as well, too, that are for different levels of government customers. So it's a great experience. There's a lot of innovation going on with the federal government. I think, you know, they realize that, hey, our systems are outdated and they're costing way too much money. You know, they're not agile at all, and we need them to be, you know, agile, and we need them to be, modern. So there's just a lot of money right now being invested into that. And you'll see that, too, with us, and you'll see our competitors are in there very strong as well, too.
Rob, I know you mentioned cloud native as well. What does that entail? Is it everything that you open the Azure portal? Do they all count as cloud native? Or is it more specific, like I usually associate with Kubernetes?
That's a great question. You know, when you would ask people cloud native, a lot of times, you know, what's the first word? Kubernetes. And I think think about that question for a second, because there's so many ways to answer that. But I think that it's bigger than Kubernetes, but Kubernetes tends to be kind of the fabric. So if you think about what is the fabric of a cloud native application, you know, no matter where you are, whether you're on-prem or whether you're in our cloud or somebody else's cloud, it's going to be Kubernetes. Everything sort of runs on Kubernetes. That's sort of the idea behind it. If you look at the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, and for the listeners who don't know what that is, there's this consortium out there called CNCF, Cloud Native Computing Foundation. They have about 400 companies, you know, many you've heard of, including Microsoft and Amazon and Google, and a lot of the big Fortune 500s are in there. But their whole idea is to drive forward cloud native technology. And one of the big things they own is Kubernetes. And so they have hundreds of different projects, you know, all kinds of different things at CNCF that you can use, they're all open source, but almost all of them pretty much backbone into Kubernetes. So Kubernetes is sort of like the fabric for it pretty much. But, you know, I always think, too, that when you're dealing with cloud native with a customer, it's more than just Kubernetes as well, too. You know, it's really about, well, we have Kubernetes, we can set it up, but what are we going to run on it? Because Kubernetes is really a container orchestrator, you know, with a lot of great features. But, you know, what about apps? So then you start thinking about, well, how do we build a cloud native application, right? And if you look at the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, they've got very specific pillars for a cloud native app. You know, they would say, well, it needs to be built in a distributed manner, microservices. It needs to run in containers. They would say you need to have backing services like your database, your distributed cache, all of those things that are pretty much not part of the application, right? But plug into the application, if you will. Automation becomes a big thing. So there are specific things that, you know, you have to think about if you're going to build a cloud native application. It really meets the specification of CNCF, which should give you the agility and the speed that you're looking for. And so when I deal with customers a lot too, they kind of jump to Kubernetes really quickly. And I think that's good. But, you know, we don't want to neglect the application conversation, because then they're building applications for Kubernetes like if they were building them on-prem, and they're not taking advantage of, you know, what's built into the cloud. And then, you know, then they're disappointed. They're like, wow, this is, you know, we wanted this, we wanted that. So again, they don't always know. And then we find them sometimes they're actually building things, you know, in their applications that already exist in Azure. So we really try to educate customers. Hey, you know, cloud native is a good thing. Here are the benefits to it. But, you know, you need to think about not only the platform, Kubernetes, but also how we're going to build the application. You know, and think about things, you know, what are microservices? You know, what does it mean to run in a container? What are backing services? You know, what does attached backing service mean? And why? And how do those, you know, what do they buy you? You know, it's kind of a long-winded answer to a short question.
Yeah, I think that was the question I was going to ask is, you know, what makes an app cloud native, and you answered that. But now when you describe it, I'm thinking like, oh, you know, I got to write all these microservices. I got to, you know, take care of discoverability or whatever else, right? That's part of the CNCF charter. I mean, it sounds like I have to write a lot of code to make that happen, right? That's what I'm thinking as a developer, right? Oh my God, I got to write all this code and probably have to learn Golang or something like that. I don't know. How can we better democratize, you know, the cloud native architecture so that it's available and more people can use it without having to write a lot of code, for example?
I think that's a great question. I'll throw one out. You know, there are things that are built into Azure, for example, that you want to hook into so you're not writing. But I think in terms of plumbing code, because I think when you get into microservices, what happens and you go, wow, I used to have this one big monolithic process running, right? You know, a module one could usually call module two, a module two can call module three, and everything's together, right? You know, now I've got service one sitting over here. Now we've got service two sitting over there and service three. So now we're going pretty much across the network, right? So all of a sudden, things that were reliable and quick, well, now we're exposed to network latency and all the things that come along with that as well, too. Network, you know, just the unreliability. You don't know if service one calls service two, you know, it might get a 500. It might get a 404. So let's retry it and all that. But I think that, so a lot of the plumbing code to write that code to say, hey, I need to make calls, I need to be stateless, I need to hook into, or stateful rather, I need to hook into, you know, some kind of secrets manager and all that. There's a framework, it's actually a runtime that got released by Microsoft. Although it is Microsoft funded, but it's open source, it's called Dapper. And you probably have talked about Dapper maybe on some of your early shows, and that's D-A-P-R. And that stands for Distributed Application Runtime. And the great thing about Dapper is that it abstracts away a lot of that plumbing code that you would normally have to write. So if I had two services and I wanted to do PubSub, I wanted this service one to publish messages out there, you know, to some message broker, say Azure Service Bus, and maybe RabbitMQ. And then I wanted to have service two subscribe to some of those messages. So I'd have to write quite a bit of code. And then I would need to write all the publishing code on the one side, and then all the subscription code on the other side, hooking into the message, you know, to a specific message broker. So if it's RabbitMQ, I'm doing it one way. If it's Azure Service Bus, you know, the interface is a little different on that. So that tends to get kind of ugly. It's ugly to build, and it can be expensive to maintain, right? But that's what you'd have to do, even just for PubSub. But with Dapper, what's interesting is that you say, hey, I'm going to run my application, you know, within the Dapper runtime. And when I do that, I'm going to consume something that's already in Dapper. It's a building block called a PubSub building block. And it already has that nasty, hard to write plumbing code in it. I pretty much just say, hey, you know what, Dapper, I want to publish this message. And it's really pretty simple because I'm not writing that code. I'm just hooking into the existing code. And then on the other side, when I want to subscribe to messages, that service just basically hooks into the Dapper subscription code. I mean, that's as simple as an attribute pretty much on top of a. So it really just throws out that code. Underneath the hood, the PubSub building block says, hey, what message broker do I use? Here's a list of the ones I support, right? RabbitMQ, I support Azure Service Bus, I support EventGrid. You plug in whatever broker you want. You don't write the code. It's already there and done for you. In a YAML file, I say, I want to use Service Bus, and here's my credential information, right? Or I want to use RabbitMQ. So again, a lot of that plumbing code, again, for PubSub, for doing direct invocation, service one calls service two directly, you know, for secret management, for stateful, you know, I want to use Redis cache, right? But I don't want to have to write all that code to hook into it. I'll just use the stateful service block with the Dapper to hook into it. So I think that's a way to do that. And Dapper is interesting. It got released in February. It's out there. People are using it. You know, we're still kind of in that adoption curve. And I think, you know, companies are looking at it for sure. And they're saying, well, wow, you know, this. So they really haven't kind of gotten, I think, to, I'm not sure what the term would be, to the point where it's just crazy adoption. But I think that's coming pretty much. And I think it's going to come because of the value proposition. You know, anybody who's written a microservice application, you know, has sort of, you know, welts across their back, right, from being whipped, you know, with all of the nasty, you know, plumbing code you had to write and maintain. And with Dapper, it does it for you. I mean, it's very slick, and you can customize it. You can write your own providers. They've done an outstanding job, and it really does. It's just not .NET Core at all. You know, there is a Go library for it. You know, there is a Java library. There are ones that I think for Node.js, for Python. So you plug in. I mean, they've really kind of, I think, simplified it to a great deal. So my guess will be that as time goes on, we'll see more and more customers looking at, and I think adopting Dapper, because again, I think the value prop, what it gives to you, is great. You know, it just really reduces a lot of the time you got to spend writing plumbing code. It does it for you. You focus on business stuff, right, going into it.
As I hear you, you know, talk and describe that, Rob, like two things come to mind. One, nowhere in there did you say that this code has to run in a public cloud, right? It can run in, you know, an on-premises cloud. It can run in Azure Stack. It can run in AWS. Like, the concepts are sort of universal. And then the other piece is that, and I really like your statement about focusing on the sort of the application logic, the business logic, because it, you know, it sounds like, you know, if I'm sort of building this right, I should be able to say, you know, if today I'm using Service Bus and then tomorrow I go, man, I really need this feature that Event Hub has. Okay, I just go into my YAML file, change my YAML file, and then add whatever whatever I need to do that takes advantage of EventGrid. And so I'm not having to rewrite all this code. I don't even really have any running code to flip my provider. I just change it in my config file functionally.
You should have, if you're using the PubSub building block, say this week you're using RabbitMQ. You decide next week you want to go to Service Bus, and maybe the week after you want to go to like another, you know, whatever it is, maybe something in EC2, who knows what, right? Shouldn't say that. But anyway, so all you're really doing is you're just going into your configuration file and you're saying, you know what, I want to plug in, it's really just a line of code. I want the provider for RabbitMQ, the provider for Azure Service Bus, and just providing whatever credentials it needs. But your base code pretty much remains the same. You shouldn't have to touch that. And I'll give you an example that was really, so I co-authored a book with two really, really good architects out of the Netherlands. They're just great. It's called Dapper for .NET Developers. It's out there. It's free from Microsoft. You can read it online. You can download a PDF. But, and you really should. Read chapter two, because chapter two explains Dapper. I think we call it Dapper at 20,000 feet. But if you read that chapter, I think you'll really get a fairly in-depth appreciation for Dapper without getting into the weeds too much, right? And then as you get into the rest of the book, then we give lots of examples, code examples. But we took something called the eShop on Containers reference application. And if you don't know this, Microsoft has this really robust reference application. It's a microservices application. It's called eShop on Containers. You should download that because there's a lot of really good practices in there. There's a book around it as well too. But we took that particular reference application and one of the guys gutted it, right? And we put Dapper in it too. So just in the PubSub alone, he pulled out over 700 lines of code that was really hard to follow. It was written well, but hard to follow. I mean, I looked at it a lot before I knew what it was really doing. But and he took out 700 lines of code, over 700, and he plugged in less than 30. Does the same thing pretty much. And the code that's in there is really pretty. It is straightforward in a sense. It's just really calling just the APIs. So I mean that's I think
that's huge, right? Because that when you think about debuggability and maintainability. Right, maintaining 30 lines of very clear code is way easier and way less likely to introduce bugs down the road or have bugs today than 700 lines of much more complicated code, right? And it means I could debug the code you wrote instead of you having to be the only one that can debug it, right? And that makes a huge difference down the road.
Yes, I agree. And think about this. Those 700 lines included code for Service Bus, included code for RabbitMQ, right? Those two things only. So now with the 30 lines of code, you can plug anything you want in. Any Dapper enabled PubSub message broker, and there are many of them, right? Like you say, it doesn't need to be in Azure. It can be on prem. It can be in other public clouds. It doesn't matter pretty much. You know, it's not locked. You're not locked into anything with it. It really is an open source framework. You can run it on prem. It comes with, I think when you load it, it has Redis in the container and all that. It's just, and it's not hard to use. There's a bit of, you have to understand how it works, right? But it's not like a monumental task. But I think getting back to Sujit's point, that frameworks like that or runtimes like that, I think really make approaching microservices much more palatable, because I think customers, having worked with microservices for a couple of years, customers dramatically underestimate the complexity of these things. I mean, they have no idea what they're getting into. And when they get into it, it's like, oh my gosh, things that were really simple in a monolith, right? Or module one calls module two, become very complicated now. So I think Dapper is really going to, and as we go forward, I think what's going to happen, I think I can talk about this, we'll see more and more and more Dapper being put into Azure PaaS services. You're already seeing it in Logic Apps. You see some in Functions. I think there's some in EventGrid, I believe, right now. But what will happen, I'm told, is that we'll see more and more and more Dapper PaaS services in Azure being Dapper enabled. So if you're running in Azure, Dapper will be very easy to use. And I believe at that point, you're going to support that. Because right now, Dapper is open source, right? So it's not supported. The community, which is very vibrant, supports it, but Microsoft can't support it. It's open source. But when it runs in Azure, we will support it as well, too. So anyway, that's my soapbox.
Along with the, you mentioned a lot about Dapper, and it, isolating you from having to write all this plumbing code. Something else that takes away a lot of the plumbing code when you're building apps is like our Power Platform and our low code or no code. You mentioned Logic Apps there a minute ago. So how does that, how do you see that weaving into like cloud native apps, like the whole low code, no code to increase productivity? You know,
that's a really good question. You know, yeah, you can't go an hour without hearing about low code, no code these days. I get, what is it, Software World or one of these magazines, you know, every other issue is like low code, no code. It's just really gotten big. And a lot of the customers that we're talking to right now, you know, even federal government customers, they all want to know about low code, no code, you know, and they're very interested in it. So I think it's here to stay. It's a big trend that's going forward. Now, Microsoft is certainly advocating or evangelizing, you know, our Power Platform, and it's pretty slick when you look at it. I mean, it does a lot of nice things, but I think the way it'll play out maybe in a bigger picture in a cloud native world, I'm thinking, this is Rob's opinion here, but I'm thinking from a front end standpoint, we'll see a lot of front end applications written in say Power Apps and all the different tooling you have, because again, really nice front ends, a lot of the configuration you'd have to do, it's done for you, or you can do it very simply, right? You can really get stuff done quick, and you can even not be a developer if you're, say, sort of like a, what'd be the term? You're like, they call it citizen developer, but somebody who's, you know, somewhat technically, you know, interested in things, right? But maybe not a full-fledged developer. You can build that stuff. You know, there's a really nice menuing, really nice development tools to do that. And you can build not only web but mobile applications as well too. So I think we'll see a lot of applications being built. The front ends will be, I think, low code, no code enabled. But the back end services are going to be our cloud native microservice type applications, pretty much. You know, and the low code tools like the Power Platform have all kinds of different ways to hook into these services on the back end. And you can build workflows and different things, but I think going forward, maybe the app will become more of a hybrid. So I think that, again, low code, no code will play into Power, play into cloud native, but it's going to play in, I think, on the front end of it. You know, and again, people will do Angular, they'll do React, they'll do Vue. Those aren't going away per se, but I think for medium-sized typed applications, for, you know, more departmental, you know, you'll see a lot of low code, no code. You know, if you're building the true enterprise application and you have millions of customers and you're getting, you know, 10,000 transactions a second, maybe you won't be building that front end, you know, in low code, no code. But most apps don't have that kind of volume.
It's very similar to what you said on the back end, right? Like, it's like if you write front end code, you can spend a lot of time and write a lot of code to handle all the different clients and things that people are coming at you with, and Power kind of like remove some of that, right? Like our platform will say, okay, here's some standard stuff that works, right? So you don't have to write that infrastructure code. But that's super cool, like how there's kind of a synergy there between them.
Oh yeah, you know, and again, there are people who, I mean, their career paths right now are Angular and React, and, you know, and I mean, those aren't that easy to use. I mean, there's a learning curve with that stuff too. And a lot of them are very good at it too, but I do see that market getting impacted by low code, no code, especially if we can say, hey, you know what, I'm a developer, you know, let me work on the back end stuff. I'll oversee the citizen developer writing the front end, but let them really write what they want. Let them pull in the fields that they want. I'll make sure that it's safe. I'll make sure it's secure. You know, I'll help them do it, right? But if we can get them doing that, then we can get more apps out there, and they can get exactly what they want. Instead of saying, well, you guys didn't quite do it right. You know, you do it. Let us help you do that, pretty much. And then I think they can make quick changes as well, too. They can go, hey, you know what? We need to put this over there and this over here. But instead of having IT do it, they can do it, pretty much. And we can just basically oversee and make sure they're doing it right. Sorry about that.
No problem. I just want to say a quick plug for a future show. We do have a special guest that's coming on in a couple of weeks to talk about Power Apps. So that's something our listeners can look forward to. But Rob, what I wanted to ask you is, you know, at the end of the day, low code, no code, custom code, whatever it is, when you're building a cloud native app, you know, and the rubber meets the road, what do we have in Azure to run these apps? Like what are the services that our listeners should be looking at to say, okay, these are my menu of services or resources that I can use in Azure to run these apps?
That's a great question, by the way. Actually, our internal Microsoft Spark conference is next week, and I'm doing a session on that very topic right now. I think we call it here a host, there a host, everywhere a host, right? And it's kind of like, you know, a customer says, hey, I want to host this. Wait a second. There's ACI, AKI, Xero, there's Azure Functions. You know, like, what do I do? But I think if you're really dealing with a cloud native application that does fit the specifications from the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, it is microservices, it's running in containers and that, I think you're probably looking at a container orchestrator and probably looking at AKS for that. Now, what's interesting is, there is another one that we support. It is called ARO, or Azure Red Hat OpenShift. And I wasn't that much involved with it, but when I got into the government accounts, it's very big, right? And so that's another container orchestrator. It's Red Hat OpenShift running in Azure pretty much, right? So it's all a managed service. So that's another one that people could look at. What's interesting about Azure Red Hat, and again, not an expert, but it's sort of like a turnkey solution. It just runs out of the box almost. You can change things around, but you know it is an end-to-end. AKS is great, but you need to put your monitoring, you need to set your networking, your security. But again, that one pretty much, you know, out of the box does a lot of things. But I think you're probably looking for a cloud-native application, probably looking at either a container orchestrator like AKS or like ARO, or you're looking to write it more in a serverless manner. You're going to say, you know what, I want to create, you know, a set of functions, right? And, you know, and the functions are very small, very granular services, but I want to run it in that particular platform. And I think we see quite a bit of that too. And I think that the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, not that they rule the earth, but I think they even advocate that as well too. So you might containerize some of your functions, but you would run them more in this, or containerize your services, but run them more in a functions environment. I think we'll see a lot of that as well too. You know, if you had,
No, I was going to say, I wanted to add a third one to that list. You know, I've been doing a lot of work with Azure Spring Cloud, and covers, Azure Spring Cloud basically uses two AKS clusters, right? So again, like I said, that complexity of AKS, setting it up, it's all taken care of. You get a fully compliant AKS cluster already set up for you under the covers. You never see it. All you're dealing with is an endpoint that says, okay, here's my jar file, or here's my 10 jar files which represent my microservices. Go ahead and run that, right? And that's it. Boom, it runs. And it's fully secure. So would that also be considered cloud native if you were to do something like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think so, yeah. In fact, that might be more cloud native than you think, because again, there's a lot of, you know, I think cloud native comes from the open source community originally. And I think a lot of that is Spring. Yeah, I mean, if you're running services and you're running them in a container orchestrator, I think you're meeting those criteria. You're beginning to meet that criteria of what CNCF, Cloud Native Computing Foundation, would call cloud native. But then here's a question for you. And thanks for bringing Spring Boot up, by the way. I think it's a good one too. But what if you built an application, say it's a monolithic, brand new web application, you build it in .NET Core 5, right? That's the latest, okay? And you push that out to app services. But you know what? You're using backing services, using maybe Azure SQL or Cosmos DB for the database. You're plugging into the, you know, to App Insights. You're plugging in, you know, it's being built for the cloud, it's being built in the cloud, and it's being ran in the cloud, right? Is that cloud native? And I kind of go back and forth on that, because the CNCF might say, well, I don't hear the microservice term in there. Right? it's running in a container too, okay, in an app service. So, but you know, again, it's built for the cloud, or built for the cloud, you know, maybe build in the cloud, runs in the cloud. I don't know. You have to think about that. It's a So yep. I guess it's really how strict you adhere to the guidance. You know, can you stay, is it a distributed application? Well, no. You know, can I scale it independently? Well, no, I can't do that stuff, but it is cloud native. So.
Native, yeah. It's a tricky question. I know that's a trick question. unrelated on that, I wanted to wrap this up over here and ask you about your book that you have written about cloud native apps in .NET, I believe, right? Tell us about that book and where it's at and what you plan to do with it.
Sure. So about a year ago, we released a book called, Architecting Cloud Native Apps in .NET in Azure, kind of a long term. Basically, it was about the idea actually came from Cesar De La Torre. He's a principal program manager on the .NET side of the house. He did a lot of the microservices work with eShop and the microservices ebook that we have, which is still a very good book. He said, hey, can you do a cloud native book? Right. I want to talk about cloud native in Azure, and I want to talk about using .NET Core pretty much. He said, I really don't want a book with a lot of code. I want a book that really talks about what this stuff is, how this stuff works, and how you can go about doing it. Something that would appeal maybe more to architects, maybe more to leadership and to developers who say, you know what, I'll put the code aside for a couple hours and just understand conceptually what we're doing here. So that book really talks a lot about cloud native. It starts out by defining what cloud native is. It's a fairly long chapter. We tie that chapter very closely to CNCF. We talk a little bit about the eShop application that we use as a reference. And then we talk about things like, well, what about, hosting and scalability? What about communicating? How do cloud native apps communicate? How do services communicate? We get into this idea of distributed data. Well, if each service has its own data, they're not sharing a single relational database. Well, how does that work? We get into resiliency. We talk about identity. We talk about automation with DevOps. So that's a good book, I think, to really understand the basics of cloud native. It's not a big coding book, but again, it really wasn't meant to be. Right now, we're in the process of updating that. We're updating a lot of the, a lot has changed in the year. So we're updating some of the products in there. We're expanding more on hosting as well, too. We're putting more about Kubernetes, more about Azure, Red Hat, more about serverless into it. I brought in somebody that I work with who I think is a DevOps he's a DevOps expert. He's redoing all the DevOps and the automation chapters. So again, it's a good book. It's free. If you type in Microsoft architecture, the second link you should see will be one called .NET Application Guides. If you go to that link, there's a whole bunch of them out there. There's books on serverless. There's books on .NET. And you'll see the Dapper and the cloud native book out there as well too. So take a look at that. You should at least read chapter one. So that way, I think listeners, you show up in a meeting and somebody starts talking about cloud native, you know what it is. You understand what the pieces are. You don't want to go to a meeting and someone brings up cloud native and you're kind of going, I'm not saying anything because I really don't know for sure what it means. So again, I think that's really, definitely read chapter one of that book. And I think it'll help. And same with the Dapper book as well, too. Read the first two chapters just so you know what it is, right? And
That's very insightful. Yeah. I know we only have to wrap up this call today.
We get excited, right?
I wish that you had so many other topics that we could have talked about.
Well, it's fun stuff.
Get you on for another show.
Love talking to you guys. This stuff is fun. I don't know. A lot of people I know in this business, it's like I have a friend who he works for a finance company, right? Really sharp guy. And I'm sure he does really well. But, he hates his job. Another guy I know is a lawyer. Okay, he's done really well. But he hates his job. I love my job. This is so cool. I mean, you can't get bored. There's nothing. There's never such thing as a boring day. And you know what? And it just keeps changing as well. So, people, you always keep your mind going. Anyway, love it.
We'll get some of those links to some of those resources you talked about, and we'll add them along with the recording.
Yes, absolutely.
When we publish this, so I'll grab them from you later. But Rob, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Rob.
Joining an excellent discussion, sharing your insights. I know you've always got so much to say about software development and the cloud, and thanks for sharing some of that today.
Also, Gene and Kale and Evan, thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. Cynthia, too, wherever she went. Anthem. And say hi to Kendall as well, too. I've not seen her in a while. She's okay, man.
Sounds good. Thanks,
buddy. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.